Hey there, Paisani! Welcome back to another episode of the Italian American Podcast, your weekly dose of Italian American heritage, history, and hilarity. I'm John Viola, along with my partner in crime, the notorious POB, the Italian American Wikipedia himself, Mr. Patrick O'Boyle. And today and next week, you're going to get two parts to an episode that we did. If you're longtime listeners, you know we're doing these things live and uncut now, which is awesome. Because
no, they're a little cut.
Yeah, they're cleaned up.
I mean, like
yeah.
Some stuff we say you're never going to hear.
Yes, if we fudge. But my point being, they're more the sort of free conversations.
Well, we're back. People have said to me we love the new format, but it's not a new format.
It's the original format.
It's the original format that had go dormant because of COVID.
Exactly. Yeah. So I hope everybody out there is
returning to our roots.
Exactly. This is a dose of the power hour that we originally intended to do, and we're going to have a great conversation. We just recorded with a friend of ours who you're going to meet in just a second, but wanted to intro this half by first and foremost explaining that you're going to get two parts over the next weeks, but also a bit of a public service announcement because this episode is going to air Thursday, the 28th of September, which is just about a week and a half before a momentous occasion, which is
my obituary headline.
The top piece of your CV, obituary. Pat is this year's Man of the Year for the Jersey City Columbus Day Parade on October 7th. And we want to first and foremost invite everybody out there in our audience to come out to the parade and hang out.
We have a wagon. What is that, a wagon? What do you call those things? A cart?
What?
A float
in the
parade. We have a
yes.
Float from a podcast float that yes. We have, and we want to invite everybody on.
Yes, you can come on,
overwhelm
be in the parade,
us.
Hang out with Pat.
Come in the parade. We'll hope maybe we'll get a little bit get together afterwards.
Yeah, we're going to do something afterwards.
Yeah, we're
right?
going to do something afterwards. Come. You can meet other podcast listeners.
Yep.
And this is the stuff we should do. We should be seen. We should be proud.
Yeah.
God willing, it'll be a thunderstorm. Watch my big no in the arc. But piss.
Yeah,
spoot. But, come anyway, because we will have a celebration, and
yeah, it's gonna be a lot of fun.
It's gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I'm playing a little drinks with my
wife. Nicole
said,
"I don't want John to go."
Nicole said she booked for the baby's second birthday party the same day because the petting zoo. I had to have the petting zoo, so the petting zoo couldn't reschedule. So I'm gonna be in the morning at the birthday party, but then I'm gonna come to Jersey City because we're gonna do an event at night. Right, we're renting
in the post
hours,
post parade. The parade starts at Dickinson High School. Some people come in, what do you call those things? Like before a football game?
Tailgate. Yeah.
Some people tailgate at 11. The parade kickoff is at 1. So we will have the float. So come to Jersey Columbus Day Parade. It's a freebie event. If you don't have any money, it's if the economy's rough.
Yeah.
And I have to thank my cousin-in-law, Anna DiPaola. Had it not been for her, I would not be the honoree. My mother's never impressed with anything.
This right. is impressive.
This is the first time in my entire... I don't think my law school... Nothing impressed my mother. This is the first time because even her email is Jersey City in it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a great event. It means a lot to me, yeah. right? It means the world to me. And I want to thank Anna and my friend Janet Bolsey. I went to law school with Janetina Bolsey. The two of them made this happen. I didn't ask for it, but they gave it to me. And I'm very moved because I'm going to be on a float going down a street that I lived on as a kid, as a small child,
wow.
that my mother lived on, that my grandmother lived on, that my great-grandmother lived on. It goes back, and my roots run deep in a very small piece of the world. Even when my father came from Ireland, he went to Jersey City. So,
yeah.
you know, and North Arlington is Jersey City uptown, so it means a lot to me, and I think that for the people who've passed in my ancestry, my grandparents and the like, I know it would mean the world to them. So we're going to have a good time.
I'm sorry I'm going to miss it, but I definitely encourage everybody out there to be there.
I know Nicole was crying. She felt terrible.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, I know. You know.
She was like, oh, Pat, right? We couldn't do this.
But everybody's going to be
your
out.
Father-in-law would have moved the party.
Yeah, he definitely would have. He would have made sure we were there. But
your father-in-law would have come. Your father-in-law was a lot of fun.
He
I say all the time, you hit the lottery.
For Avocado, everybody wants to come for Avocado, and I'm going to be there for
But not Nicole.
No.
But not Nicole.
Nicole's got very one-track mind. You know she loves to plan a party. So this will be, I'll be there in the evening, and hopefully everybody will come out.
I want to thank everybody in Jersey City, and especially Anna and Janet. I want to thank them very much. And for all my friends there for making this happen, it's very much appreciated.
October 7th, I will be there to see you at night. The Man of the Year will be there all day, and hopefully you come out and meet. So right now you're going to get the first half of this wonderful episode with our friend Brandon Ficarra, and we'll come back to you next week.
see that you're born an Italian. If you want your life to be great, see that you're born an Italiano and your life will be great.
Ciao, paisani, and greetings from New Jersey, the great Garden State. This is the Italian-American Podcast, and I am your host, John Viola. We are once again live, uncut, and in person. We are in our temporary offices right now because as of yesterday, not yesterday, the day before, I think Monday, whatever this is, this will air Thursday, we broke ground on the new studios in Little Italy. So I'm here with
how
my partner in crime.
Ro?
We didn't actually do a physical.
Well, how come she's not here?
I forgot.
You've got to tell Ro?
I forgot to tell Ro, yeah. I've been
I
sick.
Knew that.
I've been sick. I knew, Italy
and
kicked
Ro,
my
and
butt.
Ro, and Ro always brings cookies.
That's very
there's
true.
No cookies.
I know. I'm going to get a big apology to Ro. She'll, hopefully she won't mind having saved the first journey out to be here. But this is what
I
we're going to record
will.
For now.
If she won't tell you. She'll tell me.
I know.
But she brings a nice neutral cookies. They were very good.
She did. She did a good thing. She came out and we recorded there. And that was the last we'll be there for a while because as of today, the walls are going up. I mean, I was there Monday to kick off and everything is moving. And actually, I don't want to say it anything promissory.
Spoot.
Yeah, they say it should be quicker than I thought. So
With the Molloy Canal.
I know, just, you never know.
That'll be years from now.
It's going to be, yeah, it's true.
No, listen. 2027.
I
don't throw out compliments freely because when I do, I want them to have value.
Yeah.
Right? And I got to really say, John blew me away because when I was there, I saw the benefit of the foot traffic.
Yeah.
There's a mental benefit that we are in. We're on Plymouth Rock.
Yep.
Of Italian America. We could paint. Can you paint a Plymouth Rock green, white, and red?
Absolutely we can. Yeah.
And I got it now. But yeah. I don't know. Now, we were there during feast time, so there was a lot of people. Do you think they're going to have the same kind of foot traffic?
So it's interesting. I went down Monday. It was, you know, the feast ended on Sunday, but it was pretty bad rain. Obviously, we've had this hurricane or whatever. It's a tropical storm up here. So the last 2 days of entertainments and stuff got canceled, right?
Yeah, it did rain because we were down there for the karaoke night.
And it started then. Yeah, it started raining while we were there. And so I went down Monday morning. They were breaking down the feast. And I met up with the contractors and Sal, who runs all the projects and stuff like that, and Nick and all these guys. And we said, oh, let's get a cup of coffee. So we went around the corner to Ferrara's. And, of course, we walked into Ferrara's on the back end of a massive group of Italian tourists who were on an official tour. There must have been maybe 60 of them.
Probably criticizing us at the
probably Rosso. Saying how terrible it was. But they were online, so we had to wait for them to finish their orders. But they were there, and it's not unusual, you know. Tour groups from Italy, a lot of Italian students we see there. So, yeah, I think it's pretty – I mean, you know, there's downtime in the winter for sure. It's going to be quiet.
I mean, we're New York people.
Yeah, it's in our mind.
So we are. It's
in the DNA, I think.
And it's fun. I mean, the city's not as fun now as it was a couple of years ago.
Nope. Definitely.
It has not recovered.
No, it's not.
But it's still better than a lot of other places.
Yeah, it is still better than a lot of other places. And speaking of this idea of being New York people, we're joined by another New Jersey native who's a friend of ours. And he's from the other part of New Jersey.
He's the Philly
in
people.
The Philly market.
That's them. And and we love them.
And we do. We love
but
them.
They're a different country.
Yes, it is.
The accent changes, the food changes, the teams they root for changes.
And for a guy like me who comes from Brooklyn but lived in Jersey during my childhood, other than a few trips to Atlantic City, I never got to really explore or experience South Jersey. So it's really foreign to me. Like, Jersey to me is just sort of the head of that sitting man bust, and then everything else is very removed.
We're a country we're like Czechoslovakia.
Yes, absolutely.
We're two people that we just got stuck on the same country. We're really different people. Yeah. We're not different enough that we can't live in the same country.
Yes.
But we really are two separate people.
Yeah. So I'm very happy to have him come up, and I'm really thankful that he came up. Brandon Ficarra is not only our friend, but a guy with an amazing resume of experience, everything from stand-up comedy to TV and movies, and
he came up from the wilderness to see us.
Yeah, he did. He really
came. The wilderness of South Jersey with animals and deers and
all the way in that Philly market.
All that way in that Philly market. I'm so I feel honored he came up here to see us.
I do too. I'm really happy to get to spend time together. We've gotten to know each other pretty well over the past year or so. And so, Brandon, welcome to the Italian American Podcast. Thanks for coming to hang out with us.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I had to machete my way through through the jungle,
the wilderness, the pine barrens
of Cape May County.
You could have put us a blueberries. That's the blueberry cranberry capital of the universe.
Well, cranberries Isn't that in...
Now, they make some down there. Massachusetts is
like
a big cranberry.
New England is like the cranberry.
But blueberries is
blueberries
South Jersey.
Is South Jersey.
Is that right?
We should have had
and
you
Jersey
on in
tomatoes
June.
And,
yeah, but I think the that area around Hamilton, that's the blueberry capital. Yeah, I would have liked those blueberries. So we invite you on an off season. I
wasn't on, it wasn't on the way.
Jersey makes the world takes. Don't they say that? Or Trenton,
well,
Trenton says.
Trenton makes and the world takes and yeah. Jersey takes from everybody. Most importantly, its own citizens, its own residents.
Yeah, it is a great place to be. I don't mind coming out here while we're waiting for the studio because the older I get, you know, I went back to Brooklyn after high school and stood there for 20 years. And then we moved to the suburbs. And I love Westchester. It's great. A lot of Italians. But every time I go out into Westchester, I don't know why. I have this feeling that, like, this, it's still different than my New Jersey suburban upbringing. There's something very specific about coming here. And I enjoy it. Like, when we went to Rutherford to play bocce and have pizza and stuff like that. There's something about
Cafe Rome was across the street. I mean, they were on vacation.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that would have been a great setup. You have the bocce courts across the street from Cafe Roma.
Yeah, Jersey's just got
something.
What
more could you ask? There used to be a bread bakery next door.
Yeah.
There's a Bombonieri. Within a Pauline shot. You could throw a Pauline to a Bombonieri store.
Yeah, it's true.
Really, the first Neapolitan brick oven style pizza, Cafe Capri, which is next door.
There's a lot to offer. I don't know. Jersey.
Cafe Monte San Giacomo's around the corner.
I like it here. I do. I don't
wow.
mind.
Wow.
I like it. Yeah. I ran out.
Did you
I ran
say
away
that?
From it. But yeah.
I'm going to.
Maybe it's your version of Jersey that I really like.
I'm going to die.
I grew
you
up in,
said that?
Yeah.
You spent a lifetime
hating
disassociating
yeah.
with this place.
I know. Well, I think because I grew up in such an
Irish
place.
Oh, I got it. You're
going to
kill me now.
There was no Italians in my town. You grew up in what town, Brandon?
I grew up in Ocean City.
Oh, you grew up in Ocean City.
Very Italian.
Yeah, you were telling me about that before. What's life like down there for the Italian community?
Well, so Ocean City is a dry town, first of all.
Really?
Which is interesting.
Meaning no alcohol sold.
No alcohol sold.
No bars?
No bars. No restaurants. I mean, there's restaurants, but no
wow.
bring your own or service.
Really?
You can drink in your house. That's it.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
Gay Talese is from Ocean City.
Okay.
The New York Times. Former, he was the editor of the New York Times, wasn't he?
I don't think he was the editor, but he was one of their top writers.
He was pretty far up the
yeah, he was a
that
big
pecking
deal.
Chain.
Yeah, he's like
and
90
he wrote,
something.
And he wrote one of the definitive Italian American books, Unto the Sons.
Huh.
Yeah,
and his father was the tailor in Ocean. I thought they'd have like a Gay Talese Street or some kind of
Are you sure?
Yeah,
Ocean City.
Oh, he's from Ocean City, 100%. You got to read his book.
That.
You should really, as an Ocean City person.
Yes.
Because he writes about his childhood during World War II
okay.
in Ocean City.
So my uncles, great, great uncles, obviously. I'm very young and handsome. You can't see me on this podcast. These guys will vouch for that.
Yes, of course.
But my great uncle died in the Battle of the Bulge, I believe.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Like 21 years old and whatever that was, 44.
Yeah, 43, 44, something like that.
But all of my uncles from Ocean City, great uncles served in World War II. Yeah, they have a nice little memorial park there right by the Tabernacle.
That's nice.
Right outside of Ocean City High School. But it's an amazing place. It's an island. So you're on like a barrier island. And so growing up there, I know Pat and I are the exact same age. Me, John, you're a couple years younger.
He's just a kid.
We literally, it was, you could ride your bike from anywhere in the island. So you were the self-contained, independent childhood. It's about, now the population's larger in the winter, but it used to be in the winter, it would clear out. There was like maybe 10,000 people in town. That would balloon up to like 150,000,
wow.
200,000 in the summer. So then you had blocks and blocks of rental properties that just became places where young kids could cause trouble.
Wow.
Which is a lot of, we had options.
Yeah, no kidding.
If you were a vandal in the 1980s in Ocean City, you would get tired before you ran out of things to vandalize.
That's really wild. I had no idea. First, I didn't know it was an island. And secondly, I had no idea it had such a healthy Italian population.
Huge.
Is there a lot left down there of Italian stuff?
A good amount, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's I have a family home there that they've had in the family for over 100 years. And on that block, it used to be like a family block. They had like their cousins at a place,
yeah.
And my great grandfather had like you know, three or four different lots. One was just a farm, like a farm. Imagine a little, you know, lot.
An empty lot. Yeah, of course.
But no, there's a huge Italian-American history in Ocean City.
That's we got to go explore that.
Did your family go to Philly first? They must have.
So, no. Part of it. Yeah, so I have family in Philadelphia as well.
Yeah, all the Ocean City Italians will go back to Philly.
The great-grandparents who ended up in Ocean City came, so I don't know where they came in through, but they came specifically to go to Ocean City. There was already people there.
Wow.
Yeah, they had
it. So it was
a
straight shot.
That was already a colony.
Yeah, my great-grandma.
The Philly people were the founding fathers of that.
Makes sense. It's not that far, right?
Were they in the hospitality industry?
That's not bad.
Who's they?
Your family.
My parents were in gaming. Because
that's a hospitality. That's a big, that's the name of the game down there.
Yeah, but they were in a lot of stuff. Like, you know, an uncle worked at the water company. You know, other uncle was a contractor. So they did lots of stuff. But, yeah, there's some hospitality sprinkled. I grew up, that was how we cut our teeth. Like, my first job was washing dishes on the Ocean City Boardwalk.
Wow.
You must have had a lot of fun.
A blast.
Because we're the same age working that boardwalk. Because I would know Wildwood. The North Jersey people went to Wildwood. But Ocean City is like yards away. So you must have had a very good time on that boardwalk when everybody came in.
So here's the thing. You hit your high school years, and all the kids from Ocean City High School get jobs on the boardwalk. So, like, you remember, like, in Goodfellas, like, you know, how when he's walking, took Karen on the first date, and they're bringing the table over for him, and he's just getting, like, you know, walking through the kitchen, looking at the suits.
Sure, yeah.
It was like that. You didn't have to ever reach for your wallet. Because everything worked in barter. So if you worked at the ice cream place, I worked at the movie theater, you want to see a movie, you come on in.
Yeah.
But when I go over there, I'm getting an ice cream.
I'm getting the ice cream
now,
out of you.
This would all be, you know, all the owners of those businesses would be upset about that should any of them had paid in check and taken out taxes. But you would literally, I'm 16 years old, getting an envelope with like $1,300 cash in it.
Wow.
And then, because we would work like 80 hours a week and you could just walk up down the boardwalk, whatever you wanted. You had a friend who worked there, and it was like, here's this. Okay, you want that? And it was this magical, magical childhood.
It's a different world, really, if you think about it. First of all, think about young kids. I mean, I got my working papers at 14. I was up here in northern New Jersey, and I remember my dad said to me, you know, you want to get a job? You know, I'll sign your papers, whatever. And I got a job on the weekends as a busboy at a local luncheonette that was owned by an Italian guy from another town. He came from Madison, which had more Italians. And I just loved the guy, and I would go in at, like, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and Sunday and do the newspapers. But I don't know, maybe kids do that stuff now. I don't know. I don't have any teenage kids. But
it's
just a different
world.
Psychology.
It's hard. You know. Those jobs don't exist.
They don't exist, yeah.
In defense, too, you know, everything has a camera today.
Yes.
So you would have ran over with ice cream cones for somebody, okay, because you gave me, like, the fresh-cut French fries, and somebody would have caught it on a camera.
Yeah.
And you would have been caught, you know, the camera world has taken all that kind of fun away.
Yeah, it really has. Yeah.
I think, I understand, like, I think for sure the cameras change things. I think that we still would have done the same.
you think they're still 100%. Paying kids with the envelopes full of cash?
That's such a Jersey thing.
Here's an
envelope. Yeah, no kidding. But there was a few pretty big lawsuits or people who went to jail for tax evasion. So less and less, but it's a cash
business. The feds destroyed every happiness in life. They came in. Like, how are we at a $31 trillion debt? Like,
no matter what you get,
you keep spending anyway. You can't leave us alone.
We just wanted you to pave our roads, have fire and police, and we didn't want to pay. That's all we wanted.
Yeah, that's true.
Services for nothing.
Yeah, that would be nice. What an ideal.
No, but I mean, it's like, I feel that giving you as a child an envelope, large amount of cash, should be exempted from interference by the feds. Because that was like community money. That was like educating a child on how to build a community.
You're right. And it's also, I mean, it stays
free
in the community,
ice cream
right?
Cones.
Yeah, people are there.
Sure.
It is
And what
true.
Do we do with all this money anyway?
I don't know. I don't know where it goes.
New Jersey has third world roads, right? And you go other
Not
parts
South
of the country.
Jersey.
You have roads better?
South Jersey. Oh.
We didn't have, how was it when they wanted Beautiful. To redo the Pulaski Skyway? New Jersey didn't have the money.
Yeah, I know.
They built the new Giant Stadium. They didn't have the money for a dome. Who are they kidding? In a place where an average house has an $18,000 in property tax, where does this all go?
It's a great question. It is.
They got a shakedown a kid for an ice cream cone. Really?
I was at the Giant Stadium, MetLife Stadium, whatever it's called now, not long ago, my dad and my brother for the Jets' horrible first game of the season. And my dad's looking out at the crowd, and he says, I can't believe they built this without a dome because, you know.
They ran out of money. Yeah, they did. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah. All these other stadiums have retractable roofs and stuff.
It's laughable. But it's absolutely laughable.
They did
spend
$8 gazillion on that American Dream Mall.
Sure. I've yet to go there.
Neither have I. Apparently, it's an Italian guy who got stuck with it now, like kind of owns it or is managing
If you're
it.
Living in a part of the world, I can say that now because we have listeners in Australia and Canada. Yeah. If you're living in a part of the world or part of the country, you know the American Dream. I don't even know what I would – It's like New Jersey tried to put Disney World in a mall.
Yes. It's the greatest boondoggle, I think, in the history of American property
development.
No,
it's in New Jersey. It's not a boondoggle for the people who made money on it.
No, but
there's plenty of envelopes that they got, so there are plenty of people who say, you know what, John, that was not a boondoggle. Yeah. That went just to plan.
It was started right before the bust in 2008. It's got an indoor ski slope. It's got an indoor wave pool. It's got Ferris wheels. But it's like basically empty.
Is it operational? I never heard of this.
You never seen this thing? It's right next to Giant Stadium.
You're from South Jersey.
It's open.
Thank you.
I don't think it's full.
We do things that make sense down there.
It's yards from where we're taping, really.
Yeah, it's really quite close.
Why are we taping here in this little conference room and not?
We probably should.
We should.
That'd be great. We
could
probably
get
space for $1 a day or something like that. It's huge. It's the biggest mall. That's only the Mall of America, I think, in the country.
So they built a mall. Nobody saw. 2008, you said?
I think they started.
They started like 1999. They've been doing this for
99, 2000. But by 2000, I mean, it was slow because it was Jersey. Nothing was working right. And then 2008, the bottom just fell out of it. Yeah. And they just kept pouring more money into it.
I'm sure there are Jersey politicians who are retired now who were making on the books $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
Who were involved with that, who probably have bazillion-dollar houses somewhere in Florida.
There was like a whole period. There was like a five-year period where it was just sitting there rusting. And then they kind of went back in, and it's really bad. I mean, if there's some poor paisan holding the bag on this thing, I hate to disparage it. We haven't been. I haven't been. But from everything I understand, and it cost billions and billions of dollars. It's not a great piece of pride for the northern New Jersey area. No. But
so, in summary, no dome.
no dome on the stadium.
That's too bad.
No, I know. It's kind of an embarrassment.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
But you left Jersey and went out to California to pursue a career in entertainment, right? That was your. What drove you for that?
I always wanted to be a comedian since I was very, very young, which is an odd thing to want to be, I think, for in general. But my parents worked at the casino, so I had the benefit of going to the Sands and seeing, you know, Billy Crystal, Jerry Seinfeld. Like, I saw all these comedians as I was growing up. And it's the only thing I wanted to do. So I started doing stand-up on the East Coast. And then once I realized I was good at it, I went to the West Coast in like 2004 and spent 18 years out there. I did TV shows, a lot of stand-up. And then after the pandemic, I just decided, you know, I kind of got away from acting. And when that happened, I didn't really need to be in Los Angeles anymore.
Yeah. So we were talking a little bit off mic about, because I always think of comedy. I had a roommate that Pat knows, my buddy Cena, who's a podcaster, and tried to get me to do podcasting. And
that's a whole other episode.
In college, that's amazing.
All
I don't
the
know
prime
how,
hair.
Cena, I don't know how he...
Cena and the Mudanda episode, right?
So Cena was a stand-up in college and did a lot of stuff around the city. I used to be his roommate and his guest at a lot of, like, the Bringer shows and things like that. So I always felt like I was sort of peripheral to this culture, which is its own really distinct culture, stand-up comedy, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
We talk a lot about being Italian-American as being part of a tribe. Right, there's these tribal rites, there's these sort of bellwethers and symbols and languages, and comedy is kind of its own tribe, right? Like people, it's very inward-looking, it's reflective, and there's a great reverence for the history of it for people who are active in it.
Sure.
Do you know, you got to see all these greats, the Billy Crystals, Jerry Seinfelds, but we as Italian Americans have had some really interesting contributions to its history. Anybody stick out for you as an Italian American comic that was either influential or at least that you held high?
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot, right? I feel like Italians in the pecking order of ethnic groups is high up, and you know, we have a lot of comedians. But when I got the opportunity to see him live, actually a tragic story for his life, but Richard Jenny, to me, is one of the most underrated stand-up comedians of all time. I think he was brilliantly funny. Passed away in 2007, and unfortunately had some at his own hand due to schizophrenia and other things. But to me, Richard Jenny is the tops. I think some of the guys now doing it, you know, Sebastian Maniscalco, is he does a really good job of capturing, you know, if not the Italian culture, like the Italian neuroses.
Yeah,
you know, I think it's that kind of passion. You know, I think that comedy works well. I feel like just being funny. Let's take away, you know, the idea of being a professional at it. But I think most Italian people I've met on some level desire a deep connection. And whether it's through food, whether it's through art, whether it's through argument, you know, guilt. You know. comedy is a way to connect on that deeper level. You know, I've often told people, like, you know, if you make somebody laugh, they'll like you. Mm-hmm. If you laugh at somebody else's humor, they'll love you.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's that kind of connection. So I think Italians always look for ways to make deeper connections, and that's why it's a humorous group. You know, whether it's, you know, busting chops or it's just being funny, and you know, it's usually seems like it's teasing.
Yeah.
When it's in the family and in the community. Like, you know, our family, it was like, if you're not willing to laugh at yourself, you know, don't worry, we'll laugh.
I know that from my family. It is interesting you use the word busting, the phrase busting chops, because I always look to put a label on that kind of, it's not sarcasm, right? And it's I think it's a big part of our culture, that sort of gentle teasing, very, busting chops, yeah, is a great way to put it. And that's something that I grew up with. That was, I could, you know, my dad and his friends, or my uncles and aunts, and the adults in my family, it was this great teasing. It was never mean, but it was just busting chops.
Oh, no?
It was like, if it was mean, I didn't pick up on it. But, mean was mean. We had mean, certainly, streaks. But, this idea that there was something very funny. Humor was a big part of our Sunday macaroni, of our family events, of, you know, just that sort of gentle teasing of each other. And it was a big part of how we communicated with each other.
A different haircut, you know, a different, like, there was no, like, if you took any sort of fashion chance, Sunday dinner, like, there was a 0% chance it wasn't going to be a dress.
Everything got brought out into the open. I think that's a big deal.
I remember camo when I was like probably 10-12 years old. And it was like, you know, camouflage, like, you know, go to the Army Navy and get camouflage pants. So I'm wearing camouflage pants and camouflage t-shirt. And I'm playing, like, street hockey with my friends in Ocean City. And my dad happens to be driving by and pulls up. And it's like the last thing, when you're 10, like, you don't want pet nicknames. You don't want anything, right? Rolls down his window and goes, "Hey, salad guy, come here." It's like, here I am thinking, seeing myself as Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando.
Of course.
And he reduced it to salad guy. And it was just like, I don't know what.
I hope that doesn't stay with you. Salad guys, hope you shed that one quick.
Well, it's still with me in here.
Of course.
I got to ask you a question. In your L.A. days, did you ever feel you were different from the crowd because you were an Italian from New Jersey? Did you ever culturally feel, I think differently or I see things differently?
You know, I didn't feel isolated because there is a decent amount of Italian comics. So,
because there's like a connectivity we all have here at the table.
Yeah.
If we were here eating, we could be here for 12 hours because we get each other, right? And John, I've said there's other people we sit down with who don't have that wavelength. Did you ever feel being outside of that there was a different connected? I don't know if I'm like, but you get it. I don't know how to articulate it.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, we connect on different levels, right? Like, so the way that we have, like, a shared, you know, history through age and culture, right? If I was in a room with two people who had my, you know, shared a love of Philadelphia sports, which I don't have at this table, then I would have that commonality, whether they're Irish and German or whatever. So I think that when you're in that world, and it is very kind of, it's a closed shop with comedians. You know, they kind of, we kind of huddle together. So when you're with other comedians, there's that bond. But when you're with, now I've done shows that are Italian American, you know, lineups, and we did a thing, the Meatballs of Comedy, for like, you know, every week. So that was different. It was like you had like a double bond.
What was that like?
It was awesome. I mean, there's some great Italian American comedians, Vinnie Coppola, Tommy Tallarino, like these guys. And so it was like this, where we'd sit around and chop it up with that shared history.
Yeah.
You know, when they're talking about their upbringing or their families, like, you know exactly what they're, you know, it's a shared culture. So, but then when you're talking comedy and you're talking about the nuts and bolts of comedy or the reaction to what's going on, you know, everybody's got that too. So it's it was really neat. It felt very comfortable.
Was that a show, the Meatballs of Comedy, was that a show you were doing live as like a stand-up tour?
Well, tours in L.A., yeah, we're touring Italian restaurants and pizza.
were you getting a lot of Italians in the audience?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I have actually met Henry Hill.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right before he died. Like maybe really? About 6-8 months before he died. I got a picture.
That's what the guy was that like? Was Ray Liotta portrayed in Goodfellas, for those
exactly
who don't
right,
know.
Yeah. Henry Hill from Goodfellas, or the Wise Guys book. What was it like? It was a little intimidating, but I've met a lot of, you know, connected folks. I mean, in entertainment, I don't know how
course,
to say it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people who probably would have known Henry Hill.
And colleagues and associates.
But he was different. Now, that guy, like, so, you know, they show it in the movie, right? Some substance abuse and things like that. Yeah. This guy was affected.
Yeah.
Like, he had some problems.
Yeah.
So he was not nice. You know, we took a picture. He was fine, but he was belligerent and drunk, and like it was hard to do the show. Like, he was, it wasn't pleasant. I didn't enjoy.
Wow.
It's more of a neat picture to show people, but I remember at the time thinking, like, you know, I don't love this guy.
I think about my, that reminds me of my picture with DiMaggio, who I will never say a bad word about, but he was a hero of my family.
You have a picture with Dom DiMaggio?
No, Joe. Joe.
That's his brother, right?
Yeah,
wow. Yes. Well, that's cool, too.
The other DiMaggio. I never met Dom, actually. I got a picture with them when I was a kid at an event my dad did for the Yankees. The Yankees won the first Subway Series regular season. No, the regular season interleague play, 97, when they won the, you know, best of whatever they played. Sure. And he was the guest of honor, and he was, like, hiding in another room, Windows on the World in the Trade Center. And I went with my uncle, who was a big baseball fanatic and sports collector, and we snuck into the room, and there he was with his lawyer at a table by himself. And I said, yeah, Mr. DiMaggio, my grandfather came from Italy, and even though he was from Brooklyn, he became a Yankee fan because of you. My grandfather was at the tail end of his life. He was very sick. I said, I would love nothing more than to take a picture to him. And I had the disposable camera, and he looked up, and he didn't say anything. He just, like, you know, put his arm, kind of turned towards the camera with me, and let me take this picture. I still could see it in my head. I'm giddy like a schoolgirl with this big grin. And my uncle, like 6'5", then DiMaggio turns back around. He says, Mr. DiMaggio, can I take a picture? And he turned to him, and he said, I took my picture with the boy. We had our fun. Let's just leave it at that. And I thought to myself, this is like, you know, there is a certain surly side to who we are that, like, maybe you shouldn't meet your heroes, you know.
Well, in 97, he must have been.
He was only a year away from his passing.
Yeah, so he was an old man.
Yeah, he
was. So you kind of make a little exception for that, too.
I don't even know if I can tell this on the air, and I'm not going to. I worked at Yankee Stadium for a year in 2000 when we beat the Mets in the Subway Series. And someone that I know and trust who worked there for many, many years told me when DiMaggio last appeared at the stadium, and I don't remember what year it was because he died in 98. He was mad about something. And, you know, when the Yankees used to walk to the dugout, there was a sign. It was famous because Derek Jeter used to tap it for good luck every time he went out to a game. That was quoting DiMaggio, said, I want to thank the good Lord for making me a Yankee, Joe DiMaggio. And that was there until the day they knocked down Yankee Stadium. And this guy told me the last thing Joe DiMaggio said when he left the stadium, because somebody agitated him, was, I hope this place burns to the ground. I thought to myself, that's very Sicilian. Like, you know,
I think you should keep that in.
I'm going to keep it
I
in.
I hope
yeah.
that does not
yeah,
get
yeah.
on the cutting room floor.
No, I'll keep it in.
You know what? That's a great.
Not cutting anymore.
It's like when we found out about how the Prince, what was it, the Medaglia d'Oro?
Yeah,
Prince
Spaghetti.
We
got to redo that episode because the audio got destroyed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we don't have the audio.
You got something now for Yankee historians.
Yeah, yeah. I
there's a Yankee historian one day that will quote the Italian American podcast.
That's absolutely right. I'm not going to give the source till they tell me. But it's an Italian person as well, so it's Italian American source. But yeah, DiMaggio. You know, sometimes you meet your heroes. It's not exactly ideal, but yeah, I find it interesting to think that you were doing shows out there, you know, with other Italian American comedians for primarily an Italian American audience. Because I think back in the history of any kind of entertainment, right? I've been doing this a lot lately. Like, I've been researching our portrayals, and if you can go back to the 1940s and 50s and like radio shows, like Life with Luigi was a radio show that became a TV show, and it was a non-Italian American portraying a very stereotypical Italian, you know, in a nice enough way. He was a good citizen and whatever. I think, to me, at the heart of any comedy, whether it's stand-up or not, is Abbott and Costello. And Lou Costello never really played his Italianness, but his brother-in-law, whose name I'm going to forget, portrayed Mr. Bacigalupo.
Dominic Costello.
Was that his brother? That was his brother-in-law. That was his wife, his sister's husband or something like that, yeah. And he played Mr. Bacigalupo with the heavy accent on the bakery, whatever. And I think about, you know, those portrayals. And then you think to, like, the 60s and 70s when you get, particularly a stand-up is exploding, and you get a guy like Pat Cooper, right, whose real name was Pasquale
Caputo.
Did you ever watch Pat Cooper?
Yeah.
Nothing like, you know, religiously.
No.
I met him in person.
You did?
Yeah, on two occasions.
Another famously not particularly nice guy, actually.
He was a very... Listen, I'm not going to stand here and say I'm an expert on Pat Cooper. No, I should say I met him at two periods of my life. With the Villa Roma, right? My Italian childhood was taking bus trips with Holy Rosary in Jersey City to the Villa Roma.
The last Italian bocce belt resort.
And the big weekend was Labor Day weekend, the close of summer. So they would always get a singer or a comedian who had national recognition, like a Jerry Vale type person or a Pat Cooper. And I was there. It had to be the 85, 80, not even, 84, 83. And my grandparents had all the Pat Cooper records.
Sure.
Right? They had the albums. And so that weekend, they brought me to meet Pat Cooper at the performance at Villa Roma. Right? So we're staying there, and he performs at nightclub, and I meet Pat Cooper. He was very nice to me. Very nice to me. And my aunts are taking pictures, like, you know. And then I met him later in life, I was in my 30s, because someone I knew had hired him to do promotional work. So I met him in a hotel, I guess it was the lobby of his building, maybe, a hotel lobby in Manhattan on, like, a Sunday night at 8 o'clock. It was raining outside. He was a very tall guy. But what you saw on air was what he was like in person.
He was a chop breaker.
Very high strung and almost like nervous almost. Very high strung guy. Very, very high strung guy.
Wasn't laid back like you?
No. He was going slow, nice. You want to know? I think a lot of my mental illnesses come from my mother's side. My mother says you're crazy like the Lodaros. That's her mother's side. And my mother thinks they were all high strung. And Pat Cooper... He's always identified because his father was from Mola di Bari, where Roe was from, right? Yeah. But his mother, I think, was a Gargiulo, and that's a Sorrento name.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, and my mother thinks the Sorrento side is where all the high-strung... She goes to all my cousins on my mother's side. She's like, you're all crazy. But he was a high-strung... So the guy that hired him to do promotional work, because at that time he was big on Stern, right? So the alcohol... There was someone in the alcohol industry who hires him to promote an alcohol brand, thinking that he'll be able to get it on Stern because of the affiliation that they had had. And I think they were visiting liquor stores. They were going from store to store and to sign product or whatever, however the promotion worked. And he just said at one point, I've had enough. I'm done.
Yeah.
This is more work than I kind of envisioned.
That was it.
But yeah, he was high strung, very, but that's...
There's a certain lightness and darkness to our character. As you know, we talk a lot about the Neapolitan-Sicilian difference and, like, starkness, and there is that sort of, like, we've had our fun here. You know, DiMaggio's quote stays with me. Let's just leave
there
it at that.
There is a theory online, a real academic theory, that the term bada bing was invented by Pat Cooper during his shows.
Really?
And, you know, you think the bada bing reaches its pinnacle in The Sopranos, where the strip club is named Bada Bing. But the fact that they said that was in the New York metropolitan Italian-American parlance was that was picked up from a Pat Cooper routine.
Because
bada bing, bada bang, or whatever.
He was I mean, he was everywhere. I keep coming back to this idea that you're doing Meatballs of Comedy with Italian audiences in the early 2000s, right? Early to mid 2000s.
Yeah, like the early, like probably 2000. The Meatballs I started doing, that's probably like 2011, 2013.
And like people are still coming out. And when he was around, you had guys like Luke Carey and a lot of other Italian Americans.
Luke Carey, I think the difference with Luke Carey as a comedian is Luke Carey was a very ethnic comedian. Right, and he was very much identified as Italian American ethnic, and also in New York.
Right,
he's very. I've never heard of Luke Carey playing outside of New York. Yeah. I mean, he might have. I guess he was big in the '70s.
Yeah,
right. But it was a very ethnic humor.
Yeah,
you know, John collects everything in Italian America. John has comedy albums.
Yes,
which were New York produced local comedy albums, which have a lot of. So it's you can see it's geared for the first generation American born. The crowd that's born, my grandparents' generation, right before and right after World War II. They're the generation who grew up speaking Italian at home with their parents who had very limited English. And New York predominates with Neapolitan, right? So these comedy albums would have a lot of Neapolitan words and Neapolitan comments thrown in, right? Especially words that were dirty, shall we say?
Yeah.
And that was thrown in. So they would say the dirty word in Neapolitan, and the whole room would just kind of erupt. I've never heard any off-color comedy routine by Luke Carey. Nevertheless, a lot of those people, the in-person show might be a little bit raunchy, and the album was much cleaner.
Yeah.
But I think that Pat Cooper, like Dean Martin and the other ones, they were cross. I mean, Dean Martin much more so is a crossover star, but Pat Cooper, I think from that generation, was the closest that we had that crossed over into American comedy.
Yeah,
like American comedy. What do you think about Ray Romano? Because he's probably the most predominant person that carries our banner.
Yeah, I mean, what do I think of?
I mean, in the sense, and I ask you as a clinical sense, as someone who observes, right?
Sure.
Because you're a master, right? You're a craftsman. You're a craftsman of comedy, right? You're at the point that you know the maestro status, right?
The council wouldn't make me a master, but you know, they still would let me on the council, which I'm still angry about.
Do you
see Star Wars reference? Because him and I are Star Wars nerds.
I mean, because Sebastian Maniscalco identifies as Italian
yes.
American. Ray Romano, in his work, he doesn't hide that he's Italian American. He doesn't say, "I'm Ray Jones."
Right.
Right. You know, the mother. I often found that my mother loved that show, and I'm not a TV
watcher.
My parents
love that show too.
But I often found that the mother in that show, even though she wasn't Italian American,
the actress,
she did a very good. Yeah, the actress mm-hmm. whose name escapes me. She did a very good job.
Doris Roberts,
like, you know, like the, you know, the whole thing with the meatballs and the cranberries inside, the dry cranberries instead of the dry red. Like, there's certain things that I said, this woman did a brilliant job channeling us. It was very well done.
Yeah, very passive aggressive.
Very passive aggressive. But how do you as a comedian, as an expert in this field, see all this? How do you put this in a
for Ray Romano?
For Ray Romano,
I think he's been one of the more successful comedians, let alone, like, there's places around the country where, like, he holds the record for fastest sellout.
Really?
Wow. Like,
wildly successful stand-up. Yeah. And then, obviously, look at the things he did in TV and film. Like, so I think, number one, I think he's funny. Like, I think Ray Romano is an excellent, there's a reason why he's successful. Some people, you scratch your head with him, I think it's pretty obvious that he's a talented guy. I don't know him. I know some people who know, you know, some people who know who have worked with him or whatever, and he seems like he's fine. But yeah, no, I think for us as Italian Americans, I think he's a great example of, you know, the fact that you don't have to be, you know, it's a me.
Yeah, you know,
you don't have to.
That's theatrical. That's the thing why Ray Romano was so good, because he didn't try to do a 1970s Pepto-Bismol commercial.
Exactly.
Hey, you know, that's the nicest spicy meatball. You know, it wasn't, I just think about favoring one son. Not that's experience in my life, right? One son is the god. The other son is I have another son. I'm not going to throw out any names, right? There was a certain thing. I said, this lady, she got, I don't know, because Ray Romano gave her a great, and because I don't know how comedy works, did he like direct her to be that good?
Yeah,
but there was certain,
question.
But see, I like, the one thing I think about his, I feel connected with his work is, and I'm not into comedy clubs. That was never my thing. But I find, like, so much comedy today is just raunchy.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, it's funny because we're going to make dirty jokes and sexual, and it just goes way off. where I think that something I find, the artistry of Ray Romano, it's easy to make a dirty, quick joke, right? It takes real artistry to be able to transform your mother and your brother relationship into a network comedy show, you know? But I'm talking about, you're the expert in this. I'm talking about stuff I have.
No, it's a great question.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, I mean, once you get into a network show, obviously there's a lot of hands in it. You have the actors, you have the writers. Like, so Ray, I'm sure it's like, you see most, when there's a stand-up comedian like a Seinfeld or Ray Romano or the thousands of others, King of Queens, it'll have something like where it's based on their act, right? But then once that happens, so whatever they wrote for their stand-up, eventually writers and showrunners and network executives all get a hold of it, and it kind of gets, you know. So I'm sure Ray, since, it, you know, he was a titular character, I'm sure he had some say, but I don't know that he's pulling the strings to make that come across the way it did. But to further your point, you know, there's some comedians are squeaky clean, and they're really funny. Some comedians are squeaky clean, and they're, like, you know, appropriate for corporate gigs and other things. But, you know, most people, you're never going to hurt yourself laughing at them, right?
Yeah.
Some people are filthy, and they do it for the shock, and it's just the F-bombs and everything else are what they're doing for to get the reaction. And you roll your eye if you have more than three or four brain cells rolling around your head. And some people are filthy, and they're hysterical. And it's like, to me, it's, you know, words are like paint. And, you know, some people don't paint in blue.
Right.
Some people paint in only shades of blue.
Right.
But that's not going to dictate whether or not the art is good.
Yeah.
You know, for me. So I don't love the argument of, like, you know, well, if it's clean, takes real talent.
Yeah.
But if you're dirty, anybody can do that. Because, yeah, anybody can do clean or dirty and be mediocre.
Right.
But you can be masterful at either.
Right.
And I kind of, I'm, you know, somewhere on that line. The way I look at it is, like, you want to be yourself. And some comedians will say, well, I can't be clean because that's not who I am authentically. It's like, so you've never gone to your grandmother's house? You've never gone somewhere where you had to act right?
Right.
And just been an organic, normal human being
yeah.
with the slight governors of the company you're keeping?
Right, exactly, right? Yeah.
So I don't buy that either. Like, I think that you can be 100% yourself, but if I'm doing something, you know, I did an Orthodox Jewish function. As a gig, and the TV is network television is way too dirty for, like, the standards of what I. So it was the most restrictive. That's the most restrictive situation I ever had, and we had a great show, and it was very funny and it was very fun. But
how do you pull that off? Because I mean, how do you, like? I'm like blown away by that because, like, how, like, because, and I'm asking because I want to learn, right? That's why I'm saying, like, you have people that it's like when you crack jokes to people on the same page as you, you get it. Right. You know the same people. But not being Orthodox Jewish, right? Because their lifestyles are so different. It's not like you could do like a mother-in-law. You know what I mean? And they have mother-in-laws too, but it's a different dynamic. How do you make that work?
Well, first thing I did was I took my, like, you know, total of like 3 hours of stand-up comedy material I have all in, and I whittled it down to about 20 minutes of things I could use.
Yeah.
But then I do a lot of crowd work in my shows, so that helps me, right? So, you know, I can kind of ask questions, and I'm talking, and I know they have a lot of kids, you know, that's like, you know, I knew the culture well enough to be able to talk to them about it, and I'm respectful enough to not offend them even when I'm bringing, you know, humor to it. But I don't think there's nuances, there's things about Italian-American culture that's very specific for Italian-Americans, but having met enough, you know, whether it's Latinos or Armenians or, like, there's so many cultures. Jewish culture is... Like, you know, it's everybody's got a mom who wishes they made different decisions.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody has, you know, people in the family who can cook a feast that will make you never want to have another meal, you know, because it's the most delicious thing ever. And it's, you know, everybody has siblings where one's, you know, super ambitious and the other one's an asshole.
Right.
So it's not so much different. One of the things I see with, you know, with the Italian-American culture, the reason, like, if you look at Italy, like, that was never, like, a whole country for most of the history, right? Yeah. So it's always been kind of a melting pot over there.
Yeah.
With, as I said before, this strong desire to connect.
Yeah.
So one thing I worry about, and it's not a huge concern, it's not keeping me up at night, but I worry about in America, whenever we identify as anything, it can put up kind of a barrier around it, right?
Yeah.
So if I say, I'm an Italian American. I'm a comedian. I'm you know, legally blind, a disabled comic. It puts me into a group, right? Yeah. And I worry that sometimes that the thing that Italians do best is they connect.
Yes.
And so when you, it's good to have them all connect together because we have this shared history. But I also would love to see that, or do love to see when that's focused outward.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's great to connect with all of these other cultures and find those common,
yeah,
you know, that common ground. I think it's okay to, you know, to share cultures and to joke,
yeah,
with each other within different cultures and without.
That's a big thing for me about, like, what draws me into this career and examining this community over and over, and really what drew me to doing this show when we first came on, which is the idea that, like, I do think we're really good at being humans as a culture, and I think that we're good connectors. We value food, family, simplicity, togetherness, and I think that it's attractive to other people. And I think we have a lot to offer from examining our own experience, really as a window into the greater American experience and a global experience, because we are diasporic people who are around the world in different places. We are people who come from a country that really never psychologically unified, let alone politically, only 150 years ago. So we've got all these interesting experiences to share, and I think it's a great service we can provide to say, like, look at this petri dish that we are, and learn about yourself or learn about all of us as a national community. And it's a big thing that drives me here. But it's interesting that you talk about that, because one of the things that I keep coming back to around comedy for any stripes these days is sensitivity out there. And it seems like it's becoming harder and harder and harder to kind of discern the line between where we can laugh at ourselves, or any group can laugh at themselves, and what's offensive or incorrect or whatever. It's obvious that the comedy industry is experiencing that, right? I mean, this is like, it's a hypersensitive time.
Wow, yeah. I mean, the pendulum has swung. You know, if you listen to any comedy special from the 80s or 90s and had to, like, red pen it for what would be acceptable, you know, and when I say what would be acceptable, like, what Netflix would let you get away with,
yeah.
You know, it would be, it's drastically different.
Yeah.
And I think some of that's good. I think that it's one of those things where that pendulum swings, that sensitivity pendulum. I think it swings, you know, especially in specific categories or groups where people have been put upon for a long time and it's no longer funny to them.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's obviously not a joke, because it comes with all these other things.
Right.
So I think that sensitivity builds up, but I think, like pendulums always do, they always swing a little too far.
Yeah.
So my feeling is, I'm a big fan of intent. I think that for me to injure you with comedy, it would have to be that my intention was to get a laugh out of injuring you.
Yeah.
Right? But if I'm bringing light to things, and when you do crowd work, I'm teasing the crowd. You know, somebody says, in Los Angeles, they see they're an actor. I'm making jokes about them being broke or whatever else. It's all in good nature, and I've certainly offended people. But you also have to care if you offend people.
Yeah.
You know, I think that what we're finding now is that unless you broke a law, you only get canceled if you allow it to be.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like Bill Burr is a guy who's kind of proven that, where he says things that, you know, other people would probably get in trouble for, but he doesn't care. So if you don't care, there's nothing to grab onto.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a huge First Amendment guy as a comedian. I think that if you start censoring comedians, societal breakdown is not far away.
Yeah.
You know, I think that comedians are not just a catharsis for a society, but they're also a place of pure honesty, you know, where all of the, you know, because we all put on airs, right?
Yeah.
You know, if we're in business, nobody's walking into a business meeting where they're trying to close a big deal and they say, you know, I have ED and my wife is losing interest
right.
And my mother thinks I'm a failure and I might be gay. I don't know. I'm having weird feelings at the gym. Like, nobody, we all project this other thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, and in comedy, you can have that pure honesty where you show humanity warts and all.
Yeah.
You show the absurdity of prejudice as well as, you know, the absurdity of all other things. And so if you can't do that, if I can't show the absurdity of racism, let's say, then racism is allowed to be not considered absurd.
Right.
And bad things come from that. So I feel like if something offends me or upsets me, which is a really, really high bar, right?
Sure.
But even if it happens, I can say, okay, I didn't like that. That didn't feel good for me. Do I want it to exist? Yes, I still want it to exist.
Yeah.
I want things out there that could offend me to exist because it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not life, liberty, and zero opportunity for discomfort.
Right. Well, that feels like a really good place for us to leave off because this conversation really does evolve in the second half as we start to talk about what makes us uncomfortable about portrayals of Italian-Americans, both from a comedic standpoint and a dramatic standpoint, and some of the kind of psychology of what makes us us. And we're going to talk about portrayals of Italian-Americans, some of the more well-known ones, but also some of the lesser-known ones. I think it's really, really interesting, and the conversation evolves in a very fascinating way. So we hope you guys have enjoyed this first half of our conversation with Brandon Ficarra, and hopefully you'll be back next week right here at the Italian-American Podcast. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you then.
See that you're born in Italian.
Da, 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 da. If you want your life to be great.
Da, 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 da.
See that you're born in Italiano and your life will be great. See that you're born in Italiano and your life